wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down. And I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Good morning. You're tuned to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM and streaming at kboo.fm. This is Lori Mercier, your host today for the Old Mole Variety Hour, where each Monday morning, the collective of agitator moles provide interviews, reviews, and views from an underground perspective, which we hope lead to greater understanding, reflection, and action. Patsy Kohlberg is our engineer today. The Old Mole burrows down to the roots of the great issues of our time, the struggles of ordinary people for democratic and sustainable ways of life. The Mole goes where corporate media fear to tread, supporting grassroots challenges to top-down authority and giving voice to movements that shake the foundations of an unjust society. As always, you can subscribe to the Old Mole podcast by going to our page at the KBOO website. And you can also find there links to our past shows and segments with further links to even more useful information, including how to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. And you can contact us through that page or at oldmolevarietyhour@gmail.com to let us know what you think. And if you'd like to get involved with The Mole, your source for egghead, pinko, feminist analysis every week. On this week's Old Mole Variety Hour, we continue to explore strategies for resistance in the age of Trump. First, we turn to history to understand how the far right has gained so much power and whether the past offers lessons for current and future struggles. Bill Resnick and Bill Smaldone conclude their three-part series on the rise of fascism in Germany by focusing today on Nazi use of violence to defeat the left and whether the left's violent resistance helped or hurt their efforts. Then we hear Field Mole Denise Morris's recording of Joe Lowndes, who spoke in April at the Portland Chapter of the Democratic Socialists of America event on Trump and the working class. Lowndes discusses the development of right-wing populism over the last six decades and how we might build broad new social movements of the working class. Finally, the Old Mole's Tom Becker shares a piece from Walden Bellow, a foreign policy and focus columnist who insists that it's not only necessary to develop an alternative to globalization, it's entirely possible. From all of our guests today, we learn that this is a moment of both great challenges and opportunities for the left. Now, here is Bill Resnick and Bill Smaldone concluding their three-part series on how fascists took power in Germany and its significance for thinking about strategy today.
Bill Smaldone, welcome to KBOO.
Hello, Bill.
Bill Smaldone's an activist and organizer in Salem, Oregon. He served 4 years as a radical on the Salem City Council. He also co-founded Radio KMUZ. It's a new KBOO-like station in Salem. And he's on the editorial board of the Salem Weekly, an alternative paper. In his other life, Bill makes a living teaching history at Willamette University. His specialty is Germany in the 20th century and ongoing. He writes a lot. His latest book is European Socialism, A Concise History. And before that, he wrote Confronting Hitler on the tragic failure of the German left to deal with Hitler, to stop Hitler and his Nazi party from gaining political power in Germany in the 1930s. I've interviewed Bill Smaldone several times in the last 6 months on Hitler and his National Socialist Party, the Nazis, how they rose to power in Germany, and how a far right-wing party could gain power here if we are unable to solve this country's and, in fact, the world's problems. Bill, today we agreed to talk about two things. First, the role of violence in the Nazi rise to power in Germany, both violence by the right and by the left. And second, we'll talk about violence today, also by the right and by the left. That is violence today, right now, at the beginning of the Trump era. Bill, tell us about violence by the Nazis and violence by the left in the Nazi rise to power.
Well, it's a long and complicated story, but you really need to go back to the revolution of 1918 to get a sense of what was going on in Germany in the interwar years. The imperial government was brought down by a violent revolution in 1918. It was a revolution of workers and soldiers against a military dictatorship. And in the fall of 1918, in the wake of a naval mutiny that basically spread across the country, these workers and soldiers overthrew the military dictatorship and established a new revolutionary government. And that revolutionary government was based in two institutions. One institution was the Revolutionary Workers and Soldiers Council, and the other institution was a provisional government that was made up of the two existing socialist parties, the Socialist Party and the Independent Socialist Party. What eventually transpires is that the councils give power over to the provisional government, and you have the emergence of a socialist provisional government in the fall of 1918.
The workers' councils were really running the cities. These were radically democratic organizations.
Correct, and they were armed. So whoever has the guns basically wins the revolution. Right? And so the armed workers and soldiers, because they had guns and because the army was discredited, were able to seize power, and then they handed over to the provisional government. Right in the wake of that, forces on the right in the country begin to reorganize. People who feared the spread of Bolshevism from the Russian Revolution, people who were afraid of radical transformation in Germany. And many of these people organized in new paramilitary units and in underground organizations and began to launch attacks on the left. And these included widespread assassination of government officials. Once the Republic got on its feet in 1918 and 1919, it established a kind of democratic parliamentary system. And over the course of the first 3 or 4 years of the Republic's existence, hundreds of Republican officials were gunned down by right-wing radicals.
And left leaders and union leaders.
That's right. There was a lot of overlap there between union leaders and left leaders and government officials. And these right-wing organizations were violently opposed to the Republic, and this violence was exercised through the process of assassination.
Why was the provisional government unable to protect itself?
Well, the provisional government was able to protect itself to the degree in which it could recruit military forces, and this is a great contradiction, right, because the socialists turned to the old army, which consisted of nothing but reactionaries, really, to defend itself against all comers on the right, the far right, and on the left, because they feared disorder, and they feared the rise of Bolshevism. They were quite petrified of the spread of Bolshevism into Germany. So the upshot of it was that you had a government that was defending itself against right-wing radicals on the one side that hated the new democratic parliamentary order, and you also had people on the left, concentrated on the far left in the Communist Party, who wished to overthrow the Democratic Republic and replace it with a Soviet-style republic. And so the government would use military forces from the old regime to put down the radical left, and it also used its police forces to round up, as far as it could, the assassins on the right. The problem was that when people came before the courts, the revolutionaries on the left were often punished much more severely than the revolutionaries or the counter-revolutionaries on the right. Most of the people on the right were treated with kid gloves because the courts were peopled by reactionaries held over from the old regime. So the government failed to purge many of the institutions of the old system.
Like Hitler, in fact, who staged this ridiculous coup in his attempt at a revolution and was in fact just sort of accepted.
That's right. In 1923, he attempted to overthrow the Bavarian government and march on Berlin. And that was put down by local police forces, and he was arrested. And he was tried for treason and convicted. And he received a 5-year sentence, but only served 9 months. And it was a very nice 9 months. When he was in prison, he was well treated. On the other hand, many people on the left who were involved in revolutionary activity against the state were arrested. Many were executed, right, or sentenced to very long prison terms. So there was a definite tilt favoring the radical right in the German courts.
There was also some violence by the left. You pointed out that there was a group of the communists who thought that they could make a revolution, a Soviet-style revolution, and then align with this great force that they still believed in, the Soviet Union, the Russians.
That's correct. You know, they tried several times to overthrow the Republic. Each time, they were more ignominiously defeated. They just didn't have the weaponry or the numbers to carry out what they wanted to do. The other thing one should remember is that as the political system took shape, each of the political parties that organized set up its own paramilitary formations to fight the other political parties who challenged them. So as the Nazis mobilized, for example, they created a street fighting organization called the Brown Shirts. These were guys who wore brown uniforms, and they defended the party's rallies, and they attacked the rallies of their opponents, and they were really tough street fighters. The left produced its own paramilitary formations. The communists had their own, and so did the socialists. The socialists had a thing called the Reichsbanner, which was an organization that consisted of hundreds of thousands of pro-Republican activists who were organized along paramilitary lines and who defended the Social Democratic Party's interests in the streets, literally against the opponents on the left and the right. So on the one hand, you have the official government policing forces that are active, operating against the left and the right, but you also have these non-governmental paramilitary units attached to the political parties who create chaos in the streets. And the Nazis were very effective at doing this. As time went on and their organization grew, they used the paramilitary units on the one hand to sow chaos, but on the other hand to demonstrate how they would be forces of order if they came to power. So they were very highly disciplined. They did not attack enemy formations willy-nilly. They only did so in accordance with the orders from above, and they were generally used on a day-to-day basis to demonstrate the Nazis as a force of order against the chaos brought about by the Republic. So when many middle-class people feared the coming of communism, the Nazis basically tried to show that they would be a force of order that would defend against communist chaos.
This is Bill Resnick for the Old Mill Variety Hour. I'm talking to Bill Smaldone. We're talking about the rise of the Nazis in Germany in the late 20s and 30s, culminating in their winning an election, the Nazis. Bill, left violence really did not work very well. In fact, in Germany, they were really trapped because they had to set up their own violent units to try and protect themselves because, in fact, the police and army and courts were run by reactionaries. It's not clear what they could have done, actually, although had they unified the entire left, they might have succeeded. What's your sense of that, actually?
Well, you know, a lot depends on the condition of the institutions of the state, and what the socialists needed to do was to do a much more thoroughgoing job in creating democratic state institutions that got rid of the holdovers of the old dictatorial regime. That would have been a huge step forward. You need reliable state institutions who can maintain order against violent extremists who are assailing it. And this was a big problem in the Weimar Republic. You had police units that were not reliable. You had military units that were not reliable.
In fact, who were infiltrated by the Nazis.
That's especially true
often.
In the army. That's right. It's a little bit more complicated when you think about the Social Democrats controlling Prussia, which was one of the big German states, and they controlled Prussia for many years, and they controlled the Prussian police for many years, and they attempted to transform the police, but it took them way too long, and they were not thoroughgoing enough, so that when the Nazis took the police over in 1933, they were able to pretty quickly Nazify the police department and use it as their own instrument. So the Nazis actually learned quite a bit from the mistakes of the Republicans. Where the Republicans hesitated, the Nazis did not, and they purged the state institutions of any perceived opponents very quickly, whereas the Republicans were afraid of civil war, and they hesitated. And that was a huge mistake on their part.
Germany was one case. You're also familiar with the English case, where the Nazis, in fact, tried to organize in exactly the same way and were defeated. I think we should talk about that and how the Nazis were defeated in England. Some
right.
People who think that violence really works, violence by the left, point out that there were struggles and, in fact, some victories by the left who were suppressing the Nazis in the street and beating them down. But that wasn't really the way that the English basically ended the threat of Nazism. Why don't you tell us the story?
Well, I mean, you know, you have the Cable Street fight in 1936, which was a battle in which the left, led by anarchist forces in part, against a fascist political demonstration in a Jewish neighborhood in London. In that particular case, you had a very large turnout for the left against a much smaller fascist group. And they were able to defeat the fascists in a street fight. And that was to their credit, of course. But the thing is, I would not then assert that the reason why fascism in England failed is because fascism was defeated in street fighting. There are complicated reasons why fascism did not take off in England. It has a lot to do with British political culture, with long and very different political traditions and institutions in England than you had in Central Europe. And so, as a historian, I'm very leery of asserting that, well, because the left was able to defeat the fascists in one big street fight in 1936, that shows that using the fist, okay, that using violence in the streets against Nazis is what you need to do to defeat them. I would argue that that is an oversimplification of what actually occurred, that what you need is strong democratic institutions, and you need to do, in fact, as they did, you need to mobilize lots of people and channel those mobilizations against the right, okay, but you don't need to resort to force in the streets to do so.
Well, in fact, it seems to me that force in the streets can really backfire and, in fact, strengthen the right, as I think it is now in the United States when some small groups do attack not just the Nazis, but also the police who are protecting the Nazis' right to free speech.
I would agree. First of all, I'm very leery about any attempts by the left to try to match the right's ability to bring guns to bear, right? One of my big worries is that there will be a confrontation or confrontations in the United States in which armed paramilitary forces use their weapons. If that becomes part of our political culture, we are in deep doo-doo.
Yeah, well, the police are, unfortunately, who have been infiltrated, are using their weapons, actually, although with some control and having to justify it.
Well, what I would say in response to that is it's our job to force the civilian institutions, right, that oversee the police to bring the police to heel and make them use their weapons in ways that are proper, right, and defend people's rights to demonstrate.
Yeah, I would even go further than that, and I'm sure you do. What we have to do is force the police to only hire and train and be careful about maintaining the ethic of sort of constitutionalism, that is, they have to support the Bill of Rights and they have to support civilian control of police and army. Yeah. And in the absence of that, well, you get a police state.
I couldn't agree more. That would be where I would place my emphasis. So I'm quite concerned. I know that there was a big rally up in Portland recently in which the right attempted to demonstrate there, I think, against Sharia law. This was on June 10th. And there was a much larger counter-demonstration, which was good. And the counter-demonstration, I think, you know, really overshadowed the right's effort. But one of the things that really disturbed me was that the Oath Keepers organization, which is an armed paramilitary group that is opposed to the Constitution, they escorted the right-wing demonstrators during the demonstration. And that I find to be highly disturbing. And I'm concerned that the police will not be able to control the use of violence by the right. I'm also concerned about, you know, the appearance of the Black Bloc and the role of Black Bloc elements in some of the demonstrations that have occurred. But I'm much more worried about the armed paramilitaries on the right.
Bill, why don't you summarize fairly briefly your sense of the need to maintain a civil society that will put down right-wing efforts and how to do that?
So I would say that if you look at the two big examples, if you look at the German example of 1933, and if you look at the Austrian example of 1934, in both cases you see socialist movements that are defeated by fascist movements, even though the socialists have very large membership roles and they have large paramilitary formations that they try to use to defend their interests in the streets. And the reason why they lose in both cases is that they don't have control over state power, even though the states were both ostensibly parliamentary states, were actually under the control of people who were not interested in preserving the constitutional democratic order. And therefore, the institutions of the republic were not reliable. And once that became clear, that opened the road, really, to the fascists to take power. And so in our struggles here in the United States, it seems to me that we have to mobilize forces in the streets, okay, to put pressure, not only on the groups against whom we're trying to do battle, so against the far right, but we want to keep pressure on the state to make sure that the state consists of institutions that respond, right, to the people's needs in democratic, constitutional ways. Right? That is essential. It's especially true in regard to the police. So it's important that we, on the left, mobilize large numbers of people, as many as we can, and get them into the streets and get them into the process and force the state to respond in the ways that we want. We want a democratic state that can maintain order, but do so in a way that is constitutional and gives everybody the ability to demonstrate as they wish.
We have to act strongly. This is not just sort of a nice middle-class pacifist movement. We have to be strong. We have to be in the streets. But we also have to be educated. We have to build movements based on ideas. And we have to build movements that are based on ideas of a better life for those in the United States, majority of people who are now downwardly mobile. And we have to build movements that give them a voice and are actually democratic. It seems to me that when you talk about the state, you're really talking about a very different kind of state that those movements would have to create. And a state that doesn't, in fact, provide riches to a very small minority now, it's quite remarkable, and precariousness for all of the rest. That is real fear and anxiety at your heartbeat away from destitution, at least, and at minimum, humiliation, having to rely on, who knows, your relatives or something. It's very fearsome now out in the United States. We need a very different kind of, and you can call it a state, but it's really the sort of the aggregate of the desires and institutions of working people.
We need a movement, Bill, that is not just against things, right, but is for things, right? And so you're talking about the larger picture in which we mobilize people who recognize that the system is not working for average people. And we mobilize them in such a way that they are not just against the powers that be or against the far right, but are for something that represents a major improvement over what we now have. We have to really do two things at once. We have to fight against efforts to undermine the democratic republic that now exists. We also have to use the terrain of the democratic republic to build something better. And that's a huge challenge, right? But that's exactly what you're talking about. We have to educate people about what their options are.
And activate them around those options.
Yes, that's right.
Bill, good talking to you again.
As always, Bill, great talking to you.
There are all sorts of terribly worrying things happening in the world. On the other hand, things are going to change. The way the U.S. operates now is unsustainable in so many ways. There's lots of room for talking about alternatives now. So thanks for talking to us today.
Right. Just let me conclude by saying that it's a moment of great concern, but it's also a moment of great opportunity. I'm hoping that the left can use the opportunity skillfully and successfully.
Me too. Add me to that list, Bill.
Great.
Thanks a lot.
Sure thing.
Right.
Bye-bye.
Suffering. Let's resolve to start all over, make a new beginning. Now don't get me wrong, I love life and living. But when you wake up and look around, everything that's gone down.
You're listening to KBOO Portland. This is Laurie Mercier, today's host for the Old Mole Variety Hour. We just heard Tracy Chapman from her 1995 album, New Beginning, and we heard Bill Resnick conclude his three-part interview with Bill Smaldone, professor of history at Willamette University and author of the book Confronting Hitler, about whether comparisons of totalitarianism apply to the current situation in the United States. You can hear their previous two discussions on the rise of fascism in early 20th century Germany on podcast on the KBOO Old Mole Variety Hour website. Now we turn to more recent history to understand the Trump phenomenon with Joe Lowndes, an activist and a professor of political science at the University of Oregon, where he studies right-wing movements, populism, and radical politics. He is the author of From the New Deal to the New Right, Race and the Southern Origins of Modern Conservatism, and is currently writing a book on the right-wing populism in the U.S. Denise Morris recorded Lowndes this past spring at the Portland chapter of the Democratic Socialists of America-sponsored discussion on Trump and the working class. In part one this morning, Joe Lowndes talks about the development of right-wing populism over the last half century and the implications for building broad social movements on the left. Part two will air August 14th and feature journalist and organizer Arun Gupta, who talks about his year of living Trumpishly on the campaign trail and how to make sense of the billionaire Trump's mass appeal. Now here is Joe Lowndes.
Thanks everyone for coming out tonight. I've spent a lot of time in the last year going to Trump events, Trump rallies. I think it's important actually to back up a little bit and try to figure out how we got here. There are a couple of dichotomies I want to talk about, which I think pervade left thinking about Trump and Trumpism. And one, which gets repeated over and over, is the relationship of race and class, or in other words, did Trump support primarily come from people because of racial resentment, xenophobia, etc.? Or was it the result of a sense among white workers of class abandonment, that did decades of deindustrialization, stagnant or declining wages, increasing forms of political powerlessness as a result of this extraordinary gap that what people call the second Gilded Age right now. So what I want to try to show here tonight a little bit is you can't make a clear distinction between race and class in talking about these things, because race, as Jamaican British theorist Stuart Hall said, race is the mode through which class is lived. And certainly in the case of the United States, class formation and race formation have gone hand in hand. And so there's no way to easily disentangle these things. Even to talk about something we want to call the white working class has already marked it and racialized it in ways that shape the lenses of how we think about these things. The other dichotomy, I think, which happens kind of, I think, is a debate between liberals and the left on how to think about Trumpism. I think after the election, for a lot of liberal pundits, scholars, and other folks, news figures at MSNBC, Trumpism was kind of what social scientists would call, in fancy terminology, an exogenous event, that it came from nowhere, that it was a result of Russian meddling or newly emergent divisions in the Democratic Party or FBI collusion because of Comey, and that as a result we got this entirely unexpected giant angry orange meteor that hit the White House. That's, I think, the often the liberal version of what happened and where we are. And there's no way to explain it except for that now we exist under a pall of extraordinary evil, the likes of which we've never seen before, destroying a democracy that seemed to be thriving, doing so well right after November. The other side of the coin here is how many people on the left, I think, talk about Trumpism. And I think a lot of high-profile left thinkers and writers will take this line, particularly people who see Trumpism as merely the latest unfolding of conservatism. But this is just the latest in a long line of conservative Republicans. No more brutal, no more racist, no more misogynist than his predecessors, including Ronald Reagan or Richard Nixon or Barry Goldwater, and that this is just more of the same. And I think that that's also not true. I think that the answer is that we have a little bit of both, that Trumpism is a result of a number of things that have been partly the cost of 4 decades of neoliberalism and the public world that it has destroyed. It's partly has to do with the expansion of executive power, kind of a Caesarist expansion of executive power, particularly since 9/11 with Bush and then Obama. It's through the kind of the erosion and delegitimation, I think, of Congress and the Supreme Court and other institutions, and also kind of a broadly degraded media environment. So there are these things in place, but also the growing gap between the very rich and everybody else, and Republican ideology has helped us along. Nevertheless, I do think we're in a moment where a certain species of right-wing politics, which is not representative of the Republican Party overall, but certainly not representative of George W. Bush's version of the Republican Party, is now in power. And it's the hard populist right version of it. And so I want to talk a little bit about where this comes from and what this animal is. So in some ways, I start with the mid-20s, or really the New Deal era, when there was broadly social democratic imperatives in place that lifted the white working class or organized new immigrants from Eastern and Southern European countries into whiteness, lifted the white working class into a secure and middle class status often through New Deal work programs, New Deal collective bargaining agreements with unions, later through the Federal Housing Authority, through the GI Bill, through a number of other things that we associate with mid-20th century social democracy. The thing about it was that while this lifted up white Americans, it was very difficult to get the New Deal legislation passed, particularly Southern members of Congress, without strong racial exclusions. And so you have in the Agricultural Adjustment Act, in the Social Security Act, in the National Industrial Reorganization Act, specific ways of excluding African Americans, particularly African American workers. And also through myriad dynamics in the unions, in Southern states, in other places, there are ways of keeping blacks out of other benefits that would have accrued in the New Deal, leaving blacks more able to avail themselves of relief as opposed to work programs, setting up a long-term association with black dependents and welfare, which we racial images of, we still live with today. But I set that up partly to say that I think partly what happened in the 1960s is, or the 1950s and 60s, the black freedom movement confronting these deep contradictions in the American state allowed the right, which had been kind of in the wilderness since the 1920s, to reassert itself no longer as the party of the rich, but as the party of white people and the party of white workers. First seen in the campaigns of Alabama Governor George Wallace when he ran as a Democrat in 1964, and then as an independent in 1968, and then as a Democrat again in 1972, a language of populism and a bestowing of a certain kind of dignity on white workers, who he described as being beleaguered by liberal elites and bureaucrats and social engineers above, and by black people on welfare who are rioters and disruptors below. And so in the middle you have this kind of white populist middle, which continually has to fight for its own interests. The Republican Party was able to pick up on this and build a new national party out of it with Richard Nixon. Nixon was able to draw together elements of the old white South through the Southern strategy, the new white South of the Sun Belt, and urban industrial workers in the Northeast and the Midwest, and Western populists into a new broad Republican majority that depended on this idea of the defense of white interests, often white working class interests. Nixon was deeply focused on getting union members into the Republican Party, getting people that he called the silent majority, or middle America, or forgotten Americans, to convince them that the Republican Party was no longer the party of the rich, as it had been seen in prior decades, but it was the party of white people broadly, and particularly white middle and working class people. This project, the Silent Majority Project, screeches to a halt with Watergate, but then across the 1970s becomes a kind of a political identity of white Americans, now kind of unmoored from the old Democratic Party roots and associations, but unclear where it's going to go. There are elements of right and left-wing politics across the 1970s which draw people in different directions. Conservatives and Republicans themselves were split. People associated with the National Review, like William F. Buckley, were hostile to the populism of the new right. Other people, like Kevin Phillips, who was one of the architects of the silent majority under Nixon, pushed hard for a new right which would incorporate fundamentalists and evangelical Christians, union members, and others. And so this was kind of back and forth across that time. As the 70s wore on, social and political alienation among working and middle class whites became more pronounced. There's a book, actually, which I think has come back to haunt us now, called The Radical Center, Middle Americans in the Politics of Alienation, written by a guy named Donald Warren. At the time, Warren described middle American radicals, or MARs as he called them, as lower middle class white, often urban ethnic, or white Southerners. Mars, Warren argued, had proximate roots in the Wallace campaigns of 68 and 72, but also in the more politically ambiguous trucking strikes of 73 and 74, or the consumer strike against meat prices in the spring of 73. They tended to see both rich and poor as blameworthy for societal ills. As Warren described it, quote, "On some issues, Mars are likely to take a liberal stand, on others a conservative one. For example, Amar expresses a desire for more police power. He feels that granting the police a heavier hand will help them control crime. However, Amars are also adamant about keeping many social reforms, often brought by the left, such as Medicare, aid to education, and Social Security. So there's forms of anti-authoritarianism linked with a desire for stronger police power, and a desire to hold on to entitlements like Medicare, but also lurch rightward in other directions. So this is kind of some of the politics that described white folks in the wilderness in 1970. But this group, which is kind of, partly voted for Carter in 76, particularly evangelicals in the South, came to Reagan in 1980. Reagan Democrats were union members who, driven by racial resentment, were willing to vote for an anti-union presidential candidate as long as he was seen to protect their racial interests. Reagan Democrats were key to Reagan's election in 1980, and then to his extraordinary re-election in 1984. Reagan, however, begins to split the white populist base by immediately going after unions in an aggressive way, obviously with his attack on air traffic controllers, and beginning a regime of deregulation, which then continues across into what we now call neoliberalism. Next in this is George H.W. Bush runs for president in 88. He wins, and across his first term, he begins pushing, organizing what comes to be called NAFTA. He's also an internationalist. He speaks of a new world order, and he gets the U.S. into the Gulf War. This begins to alienate some white populace who begin to more clearly ideologically articulate what their differences are from this president. Pat Buchanan ran in 92 against George H.W. Bush, pulling together a politics which was anti-immigrant, anti-NAFTA, pro-labor, and isolationist. He self-consciously presented himself as a working class candidate against the preppy elite, George H.W. Bush. He kept calling him King George and calling himself Pitchfork Pat in this campaign. He was unable, of course, to win in 92, but he's able to pull together a certain kind of tight linkage of race and class, of race and populism, and one that's drawing in not just disenchanted Republicans who don't love George Bush, but also a rogues gallery of anti-Semites and Southern Klansmen and neo-Nazis and other people who come out to work on the campaign in places as diverse as Louisiana and in Michigan. He loved populist language and loved the language of insurgency against the Republican regime. When he ran again in 96, throngs of what he called his Buchanan Brigades in many states came out with an even more vociferous anti-immigrant message, also a strong anti-feminist, anti-lesbian gay, anti-pornography message. He told a crowd in New Hampshire after he had just beaten Bob Dole in that early primary, "We shot them in Alaska, stunned them in Louisiana, stunned them in Iowa. They are in a terminal panic. They hear the shouts of the peasants from over the hill. All the knights and barons will be riding into the castle, pulling up the drawbridge in a minute. All the peasants are coming with pitchforks. We're going to take this over the top." And this is kind of the language that he's using, an insurgent language against the Republican Party, that while it is unable to win, it earns him a spot in the 1992 Republican convention where he gives his famous culture war speech. He's beginning to open up a wedge of a certain kind of white populist politics, as I've said, but also he's beginning to pull together a number of people involved in different magazines, political organizations, and intellectuals and writers, and begin to think through what they now comes to be called paleoconservatism. This is the term that invented by a guy named Paul Gottfried, who is had been a member of the Telos editorial collective, the old critical theory left journal. He's also the mentor of America's most punchable Nazi, Richard Spencer. But the most interesting person to come out of this is a guy named Sam Francis. And Francis was a Southern intellectual who had been an editor of the Washington Times, but who was finally removed from that position for saying overtly racist, really white supremacist things. And so finally he's pushed out of that position and moves on to writing for the Council of Conservative Citizens newsletter, editing that, then working for the League of the South, and continually more obscure kind of racist formations on the edges. But at the same time, he's helping to build organizations like the American Renaissance Magazine and others. He's in the news now because he's kind of a patron saint of the alt-right. Alt-righters love him, they talk about him, they quote him extensively these days. Francis, interestingly, was a diehard racist, as I said, but also understood politics as class politics. He was deeply influenced by the former Trotskyist turned conservative James Burnham in the 1970s, and he was also deeply influenced by political theory generally. His works continually raise kind of an Althusserian version of Machiavelli, of Nietzsche, of Adorno. And you see these figures coming up for him. He wrote an interesting piece in 1990. I'm going to quote it for you really quickly, called From Household to Nation, The Middle American Populism of Pat Buchanan. He writes, "If the post-bourgeois middle class seriously wishes to avoid its own extinction, it will have to evolve a new group consciousness and a new identity independent of both the moribund bourgeois elite and the techno-bureaucracy of the global managerial order. And it must aspire to form the core of a new political and cultural order in which it can assert its own hegemony." So here is almost a class politics and a class revolt against a managerial class in the U.S. I should have also said he was a close reader of Gramsci and refers to Gramscian notions of hegemony over in his writings. But for all the sociological and political acuity that Francis brought to his analyses, he was insistent on framing it all through the lens of race. New class domination for him worked first and foremost against the interests of white people. And it wasn't just that it just happened to work because of a regime of pro-affirmative action, new class elites. For him, it was really a biological question. He began referring to his former Republican allies and comrades as the anti-hereditarian right. Partly what happened from those years forward is that George W. Bush comes along, and although he kind of is using a little bit of populist language, essentially he wants to present himself first what he calls a compassionate conservative, and then builds the most diverse cabinet of any president in history, puts two African Americans as and the chief positions of Secretary of State and one as National Security Director. Bush himself comes out of a Methodist tradition in his rehab post-cocaine years. He's in Bible groups with blacks and Latinos in Midland, Texas. And of course, he's in foreign policy terms, he surrounds himself with neocons who imagine themselves building new democracies in the Middle East and elsewhere. This all is anathema to these white populists who, after 2008, come back with a rage, inflecting not all the Tea Party, but certain elements of the Tea Party with new kind of nativist, populist language. Some of it's initially aimed at not just Obama's bank bailouts, not just the stimulus package, but the bank bailouts themselves, which they partly blame Bush for, because it was Bush and Obama together who did that. The Tea Party's a mixed phenomenon, but finally coming back, I think, after 8 years of a black president, and remember we talked about white populist notion of a beleaguered white middle puts black folks below and a liberal state above as the two enemies. What you get with Obama for these folks is all of that in the same person, right? A black president. And so, obviously, the reemergence of militia groups and neo-Nazi groups across those years becomes potent. There is a resonance among people around social media, on right-wing radio, and in these far-right groups that help revive these notions of right-wing populism that then become a really robust site for the Trump campaign. If you can remember, when Romney loses in 2012, the RNC gets together and they meet on some island off North Carolina and issue what they call the autopsy. It was the kind of like, oh my God, how did we lose this one? Partly they were concerned because Karl Rove had been saying all the time, as he had with George Bush, you got to get Latino voters, you got to get Latino voters, you got to. And Bush did. Bush was able to get over 30% Latino votes in both 2000 and 2004. Romney is crushed, and so Ryan Priebus, who's now one of the chief racists of the administration, at the time comes out and says, after Romney loses, we have to reach out to Latinos, to blacks, to gays and lesbians, to women. We cannot be the party of angry old white men. He issues the report saying Republican Party has to turn away from all of its racism and nativism if we want to have survive in the future. The one thing that report does not talk about is class. The issue of class is not raised in that report, and this appears to be part of what happens for angry, alienated whites, who it's not that they are doing as badly as working class blacks and Latinos, because they're not. It's not because their mortgages sunk and went underwater to the same degree as blacks and Latinos, because they didn't. It's not because they suffered the same kinds of police abuse in the carceral state as blacks and Latinos, but they experienced some of all these things in a quite a dramatic way, and a loss of privilege, which, as Du Bois pointed out, W. Du Bois pointed out over a century ago, that whiteness is a psychological as well as a public wage, and that if you've got, at least you have your whiteness, then everything else maybe is going to be okay. For people who realize that their whiteness no longer indemnified them, someone like Trump, who would be a racial populist rage machine, could offer a coherent, or Trumpists, let's say, a coherent way of seeing the world, a fairly coherent ideology. That's a short version of how I think we got here. The thing that seemed to be most important to talk about is the danger for the left, because there are elements of left rhetoric in this white populist stuff, and I think that if we don't put the question of white supremacy at the center of our politics, in anti-Trumpist politics, then we face great dangers. I think that if leftists don't see the way that race is always invoked in class, and that race is always going to be part, particularly in the United States, of how race operates, then it's something that's always going to be our Achilles heel, and it's going to make us unable to confront and defeat Trumpism. Thank you.
We can break the cycle. We can break the chain. We can start all over in the new beginning. We can learn, we can teach, we can share the myths, the dreams, the prayers, the notion we can do better, change our lives and paths, create a new world.
That was Joe Lowndes appearing at the April Portland chapter of the Democratic Socialists of America meeting. The DSA seeks to build progressive movements for social change while establishing an openly democratic socialist presence in the Portland metro area and in coalition with socialists across Oregon. You can find out more about Democratic Socialists of America on the web, Facebook, and Twitter. Now here is the Mole's Tom Becker with a well-read read. Is a better world possible?
Thank you, Lori. A better world is possible. Is this progressive mantra merely wishful thinking, or the bold assertion of a progressive movement that is backed by a feasible strategy and praxis? Walden Bellow, a foreign policy and focus columnist, thinks the latter. Today I'm reading his recent article, "It's not only necessary to develop an alternative to globalization, it's entirely possible." Free trade and the freedom of capital to move across borders have been the cutting edge of globalization. They've also led to the series of crises that have led to the widespread questioning of capitalism as a way of organizing economic life and of its paramount ideological expression, neoliberalism. The protests against capitalism in the G20 meetings in Hamburg may seem superficially the same as those which marked similar meetings in the early 2000s, but there's one big difference now. Global capitalism is in a period of long-term stagnation following the global financial crisis. The new protests represent a far broader disenchantment with capitalism than the protests of the 2000s. Yet capitalism's resilience amidst crisis must not be underestimated. For trade activists in particular, who've been on the forefront of the struggle against neoliberalism and globalization over the last two decades, there are a number of key challenges posed by the conjuncture. First is the surprising strength of neoliberalism. The credibility of neoliberalism, to which free trade ideology is central, has been deeply damaged by a succession of events over the last two decades, among which were the collapse of the third ministerial of the World Trade Organization in Seattle in 1999, the Asian financial crisis in 1997-98, and the global financial crisis of 2008-2009, the effects of which continue to drag down the global economy. What one finds puzzling is, despite the loss of credibility, neoliberalism continues to rule. Academic economists continue to teach it, and technocrats continue to prescribe it. The takeaway from this is that so long as there are interests that are served by an ideology, such as corporate interests and knowledge institutions that have invested in it, even a series of devastating crises of credibility isn't enough to overthrow a paradigm. The second challenge is especially relevant to developing countries, is the persistence of the model of export-oriented growth. Now, this model of development through trade is shared both by neoliberals and non-neoliberals, the difference being that the former think it should be advanced by market forces alone, and the latter with the vigorous help of the state. Now, over the last few years, the stagnation of the once dynamic centers of the global demand, the U.S., Europe, and BRICS, has made this model obsolete. It was, in fact, the non-viability of this once-successful model of rapid growth in current global circumstances that pushed China, in the early years of this century, to push the country away from an export-oriented path to a domestic demand-led strategy via a massive $585 billion stimulus program. They failed, and the reason for their failure is instructive. In fact, a set of powerful interests had congealed around the export-oriented model. The state banks, regional and local governments that had benefited from the strategy, export-oriented state enterprises, foreign investors, and these prevented the model from being dislodged, even given its unsuitability in this period of global stagnation. The third challenge has to do with the fact that when the major changes in trade policy do take place, it's not because of the actions of progressive groups, but of demagogues of the right. This is clearest in the case of the United States. It was Donald Trump who shot down the Trans-Pacific Partnership that had been the object of so much criticism coming from the left. Trump may be a demagogue, and his motives may be opportunistic, but it was he who came through as one of the central demands of U.S. labor, not the Democrats, with the consequence that he's been able to win over large parts of white working class. In Europe, working classes are moving to right-wing parties in significant numbers as well, not only to a racist response to immigration, but also because these far-right parties are espousing anti-globalization and anti-free trade rhetoric. As in the case with the Democrats in the U.S., the Social Democrats in Europe are identified with financialization and free trade, and this is a central reason for their loss of credibility. But it was the non-establishment left, the left of social movements, that began and developed their critique of globalization, neoliberalism, and free trade in the 1990s and the 2000s. But for a variety of reasons, we weren't able to translate our politics into an effective movement. The extreme right, on the other hand, opportunistically exploited our message, rebranded themselves as anti-neoliberals, opposed to the center-right as well as the center-left, and now they're eating our lunch. The final challenge has to do with coming up with credible alternative paradigm. My first 2 points stress the importance of powerful interest in sustaining a paradigm despite its loss of intellectual credibility. But this isn't sufficient to explain the continuing powerful influence of neoliberalism. Our failure to move from a critique of neoliberal capitalism to a powerful alternative model like socialism provided to so many marginalized classes, peoples, and nations in the 20th century is part of the problem. The theoretical building blocks of an alternative economic model are there, the product of the work of so many progressives over the last 50 years. This includes the rich work that has been done around sustainable development, degrowth, and deglobalization. The task is to integrate them not only into an intellectually coherent model, but into an inspiring narrative that combines vision, theory, program, and action, and one that rests firmly on the values of justice, equity, and environmental sustainability. Of course, the work towards this goal will be long and hard, but we must not only be convinced that it is necessary, but also confident that it's possible to come up with an alternative that will rally most of the people behind us. Ideas matter. These are some of the central challenges confronting trade activists. We cannot leave the field to neoliberalism that has failed or to an extremism that has appropriated some of our analysis and married them to hideous reactionary values. A progressive future is not guaranteed. We must work to bring it about. That was an article entitled, "It's Not Only Necessary to Develop an Alternative to Globalization, It's Entirely Possible," by Walden Bellow for Foreign Policy in Focus.
Thanks, Tom, for that upbeat reminder by Walden Bellow that anything is possible. Certainly in the Trump era, progressives have to react and resist daily to any number of attacks on programs that benefit the 99%. Republican pledges to slash taxes for the rich, eliminate health care, double the military budget and police state. They've ramped up attacks on immigrants, people of color, transgender people, and so on. But there are also bipartisan efforts to undercut political speech and activism. As you can learn from Glenn Greenwald's piece on The Intercept and also Democracy Now! And other sources, a group of 43 senators, including 14 Democrats like Maria Cantwell from Washington and Ron Wyden of Oregon, want to implement a law that would make it a felony for Americans to support the international boycott against Israel, which was launched in protest of that country's decades-old occupation of Palestine. Perhaps the most shocking aspect is the punishment. Anyone guilty of violating the prohibitions will face a minimum civil penalty of $250,000 and a maximum criminal penalty of $1 million and 20 years in prison. The proposed measure, called the Israel Anti-Boycott Act, was pushed by the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, or APEC, one of the most powerful and pernicious lobbying groups on Capitol Hill. And they are determined to defeat the growing boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement that has been spreading around the country and the world. And even when virtually the entire world condemns Israeli aggression or declares settlements illegal, the U.S. Congress, across party and ideological lines, finds virtually complete harmony in uniting against the world consensus and in defense of the Israeli government. So this represents the most systemic, powerful, and dangerous assault on free speech in the United States and the West generally, this growing attempt to literally criminalize speech and activism aimed at the Israeli government's occupation. So we encourage you to visit the ACLU website. The ACLU has sent a strongly worded letter to all members of Congress in opposition to this bill, and also to Glenn Greenwald's piece on The Intercept, PalestineLegal.org News, Democracy Now!, and other KABU sources of information, such as the program that appears on the last Friday of each month on Israel-Palestine, One Land, Many Voices. That concludes our Old Mole Variety Hour today. We want to thank Tom Becker, reading from Walden Bellow's piece, Bill Resnick and Bill Smaldone, and also Joe Lowndes. We also want to encourage you to check out some of the websites we've referred to today, which we'll post on our podcast and our website. You can listen to the show again via podcast on kboo.fm/Old Mole Variety Hour.
If I'm a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down. And I wish I was a mole in the ground.